Okay, so we can begin with great time is paying homage to the Buddha. You have the recording. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Hey, good morning, everybody. Okay, so we've been studying now with the Anapanasati Sutta, the discourse on mindfulness of breathing. And last time we finished going through the 16 phases or 16 aspects of mindfulness of breathing. And now with the next section, the Buddha will show how mindfulness of breathing fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. If you remember, if you go back a page to 943, paragraph 15, when the Buddha introduces mindfulness of breathing, he says that first, mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated is of great fruit and great benefit. Then, that's the first statement. Then the second statement, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. And the third assertion is that when the four foundations of mindfulness are developed, they fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment. So we have one, two, three. Then the fourth assertion is that when the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance or liberation. So if you want to show this schematically, we can. You got it in the camera?
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're coming to the second step. How mindfulness of breathing fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. And with this you'll see that the Buddha takes the 16 steps or phases or aspects of mindfulness of breathing, and then he quite explicitly breaks them into four tetrads, four groups of four, and each tetrad is assigned to one of the four satipatthanas, one of the four foundations of mindfulness. Okay, so the first tetrad, from breathing in long, breathing out long, breathing in short, breathing out short, breathing in short, breathing out short, experiencing the whole body and breathing in and out, tranquilizing the bodily formation when breathing in and out. So when one is practicing in that way, then the Buddha says on that occasion, one abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Okay, now comes the interesting explanation. Then the Buddha goes on, he goes on to say, I say that this is a certain body among the bodies, namely in-breathing and out-breathing. So that is why when the bhikkhu abides, so that is why on this occasion the bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. So this is taken as the justification by the commentaries for the statement in the earlier part of the sutta that when it said that sabbakaya patisamvedi asasati pasati ti sikati, that as he trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body, I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body. So it's on the basis of this statement that the commentary says the whole body here should be taken to mean the entire in-breath, the entire out-breath. So in the earlier class, as I said, I don't really think that's the original, the intention of the original statement. But here, the way I would understand the statement that this is a certain body among the bodies, namely in-breathing and out-breathing, is simply in the sense that in- and out-breathing is a bodily process or something that pertains to the body. And so when one is observing the actual physical act of breathing in and breathing out, then one is simply one is contemplating the body on that occasion. I don't think it's really necessary to take the fact that in and out breathing is called a certain kind of body and then superimpose that statement on the idea of experiencing the whole body while breathing in and out and say this means being fully aware of the entire in-breath, the entire out-breath. But of course, different people can have different interpretations. I don't want to say that one has to reject the traditional interpretation, because either one will work. The important thing is to be consistently, continuously, and consistently aware of the whole in-breath and the whole out-breath. And then, as one does that, I think it will just be an inevitable part of experience that one's awareness comes to encompass the whole body, even though one is focusing on the in-breath and out-breath. Okay, so here we see how the first tetrad fits into contemplation of the body as a foundation of mindfulness. Okay, the second, now we come to the second tetrad. This is in passage number 25. So here the Buddha says, on whatever occasion the monk trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture, I shall breathe in experiencing sukha, that's pleasure or bliss, breathe out, experiencing pleasure. I shall breathe in, experiencing the mental formation, out, same. I shall breathe in, shall breathe out, tranquilizing mental formation. On that occasion, the monk dwells, contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware, clearly comprehending and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Okay, now as an explanation, again, this is a little bit strange. The text says, or in the text the Buddha says, I say that this is a certain feeling among the feelings, namely giving close attention to in-breathing and out-breathing. That is why on this occasion the monk abides contemplating feelings as feelings. Okay, now the word here, which is the term that represents close attention. Let's see if we have a Pali term in the notes. Yeah, it's sadhuka manasikara. So the word, the key word here is manasikara. Now, there are other passages, a fair number of passages in the suttas, in which manasikara, attention, is distinct from feeling. For example, I think we find this in Sutta number 9. This is on page 141, where Venerable Sariputta is explaining nama-rupa, mentality, materiality. This is section number 54. So he raises the question, what is mentality and materiality? And then to explain mentality, nama, he says, feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention, these are called mentality. So here there's a distinction between feeling and attention. And if you think, so this is Sariputta speaking, contradicting the Buddha, but actually Sariputta here is just pretty much repeating what the Buddha himself has shown, the way in which the Buddha himself explains nama, or mentality, in other suttas. For example, in the Nidana Samyutta, the collection of sayings on dependent origination in the Samyutta Nikaya. So this is not something, you know, original to Sariputta. And then in Sutta number 111, again this is spoken by Sariputta. This is where he's analyzing the mental factors present in each of the jhanas. And then he distinguishes what is present there, for example, page 899, passage number 4, section number 4. So among the factors present there is contact, feeling, perception, volition, and mind. Then comes zeal, desire, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. And so attention is not the same as feeling. And so for this reason, if you look at note 1123, the commentary that gives an explanation of this, it says, it explains that close attention, sadhuka manasikara, is not itself actually feeling, but it is spoken of as such only figuratively. And what is actually the feeling in this set of four items, the item that directly, explicitly, and clearly belongs in the Vedana Khanda, in the aggregate of feelings, is what is here translated as pleasure. This is sukha, pleasure, bliss, happiness. This is pleasant feeling. So there are the three kinds of feelings: painful feeling, that's not explicitly mentioned here; neutral feeling, which is not explicitly mentioned, but there's pleasant feeling. And pleasant feeling is mentioned here as sukha patisamvedi, experiencing pleasure. But when there's pleasure, it's often preceded and accompanied by rapture, piti, or joy. And so joy comes into this tetrad, and then the mental formation we saw elsewhere, for example, sutta number 44, that the mental formation is defined or identified with perception and feeling. So one aspect of the mental formation is feeling. And so when one speaks about experiencing the mental formation, that could be taken to experience whatever kind of feeling arises, whether it's painful feeling, pleasant feeling, or neutral feeling. But generally the painful feeling would be abandoned or overcome in the earlier stages of meditation. So as the mind becomes concentrated, pleasant feeling will arise, and then as the mind becomes more deeply concentrated in absorption, the pleasant feeling will become first intensified, then it will fade out to be replaced by the peaceful, neutral feeling. Okay, so it seems that really, literally, and explicitly, what brings this tetrad into the contemplation of feelings is first the mention of experiencing pleasure, and then second, the mention of experiencing and tranquilizing the mental formation. Okay, now we come to section number 26. This is the third tetrad, which is going to be subsumed under the contemplation of mind as a foundation of mindfulness. And here it's pretty much quite explicit, because all of them mention the mind. So first one, breathe in and out, experiencing the mind, you know, becoming clearly aware of the mind, not only knowing it, but really almost tangibly experiencing what is happening in the mind. Then one breathes in and out, suffusing the mind with gladness or joy. Then one breathes in and out, collecting the mind, concentrating it even more intensively on its object. And then one breathes in and out, liberating the mind, which I explained last time means it's not the final liberation of mind, not the ultimate liberation, but it means releasing the mind from successively more subtle, constricting factors. First, liberating the mind, or releasing the mind from the five hindrances. Then, when one enters the first jhana, to move to the second, one releases the mind from vitakka and vichara, that is, thinking and examination, Then one releases the mind from rapture. Then one releases the mind from the pleasant feeling to go into the peaceful, neutral feeling. Okay, so this tetra clearly belongs to the contemplation of mind. And then the Buddha says, I do not say that there is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is forgetful, for one who is not fully aware. And here, by one who is forgetful, it's literally mutta saktisa, which means one who has lost mindfulness. So it's implying that in order to develop mindfulness of breathing, of course, one needs mindfulness. And then one who is not fully aware means one who lacks sampajanya, which I prefer now to translate clear comprehension. So in other words, to successfully practice mindfulness of breathing, the two essential mental factors that are needed are mindfulness, which is what keeps one, which keeps the breath present in the mind, which is responsible for keeping the breath in mind. That's the role of mindfulness. And then it's clear comprehension that enables one, when breathing in, to know I'm breathing in, when breathing out, to know I'm breathing out. So clear comprehension is what enables one to know what is happening with each occasion of experience. When one is experiencing the whole body, then one clearly comprehends that. When one is tranquilizing the bodily formation, then one knows that. That's through clear comprehension. And so, knowing what is happening is the role of clear comprehension, and keeping the object in mind without losing track of it is the role of mindfulness. And so probably because those two, mindfulness and clear comprehension, are functions of the mind. In the Abhidhamma, of course, they'll be classified as mental factors, chaitasikas. And so these four steps are said to pertain to contemplation of mind. Okay, now we come to the fourth tetra, and this, as we explained last time, it seems that in the first three tetras, the emphasis or the focus, you know, of the two branches of meditation, serenity or concentration, and insight or wisdom, the first three tetras pertain most prominently to the side of serenity or concentration, even though there are ways of using them to generate insight. But you can see from the wording, the expression about tranquilizing each of the factors, the body, the feelings, the mind, that the emphasis is on serenity, on samatha, or samadhi. But with the fourth tetra, where the word contemplating, anupassana, is used with each statement, now the emphasis switches over to insight or to vipassana. And so we have contemplating impermanence while breathing in and out, or contemplating impermanence in the in-breaths and out-breaths, contemplating the fading away, that is the dissolution or disappearance of all of the bodily and mental factors with the in-breath and out-breath, then contemplating cessation, that is contemplating the actual disappearance or non-existence of each preceding event in the process of breathing in and out. And then contemplating relinquishment, that is the giving up of the defilements while breathing in and out. So in that particular set of four items, the Buddha says, on that occasion, the monk abides contemplating. Here I don't actually like the translation, mind objects. Or rather, now I would use, it's dhammesu dhammanupassi in Pali. So it's contemplating, you know, the word dhamma in the plural has so many different nuances or shades of meaning, that there are different ways of reading the statement, but I would take it to be contemplating factors of experience. So he dwells contemplating factors of experience as factors of experience, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Okay, and then the Buddha gives the reason. He says, having seen with wisdom the abandoning of covetousness and grief. In Pali, this is abhijja domanasa. Again, covetousness and grief. I don't quite like, you know. Abhijja, which is translated covetousness here, is like strong craving. Maybe just a synonym for craving. You know, strong desire. And then domanasa doesn't have to be as strong as grief, but as any kind of sadness, displeasure, even a slight degree of dejection, or in colloquial English we would say any kind of down mood. So it's like covetousness and grief is meant any degree of either attachment or craving or any degree of just mental displeasure. Oh yeah, this was just, you read my mind. Not quite what I was hoping for. A nice oolong. From China, from Taiwan. I just have to live with my abhijja. Okay, yeah, that's. Do you have enough light there? It says in the middle column, I don't know which.
It's
I see that those poles must have gone out.
Yeah, fix it.
Okay, so let's go on. Okay, now this is a somewhat, to me, it's a bit of a puzzling explanation. I don't have a clear explanation for this, but maybe we have a hint here. Having seen with wisdom the abandoning of covetousness and grief, He closely looks on with equanimity. How do we connect this to, first, how do we connect the contemplation of impermanence, fading away, and so on, to contemplation of dhammas, mental factors of experience? And how do we connect contemplating factors of experience with seeing with wisdom the abandoning of covetousness and grief? Any thoughts? Any ideas? And again, in this case, I don't have like the right idea in my mind, and I'm testing, do they know? But it's just to see what ideas, what might. Oh! I didn't even. Yeah. Oh, Peter, yeah.
I've always assumed that when one contemplates impermanence and sees that as the core reality, that one naturally develops.
One naturally develops dispassion because of the futility of trying to hang on or even be repelled by things.
Yeah, I mean, that could be true, but what I'm trying to say is how that contemplation of impermanence fits into contemplating mind object or factors of experience as factors of experience. Donna in the back row.
Well, we see in meditation the phenomena arising and ceasing.
Yeah.
So we just descend into impermanence of it. It appears and disappears. So that's contemplation of the process.
Okay, but what are the dhammas here?
Well, that's the phenomena.
Okay, yeah. I think that's a good way to explain it. So, because the word dhamma can be used in the broadest sense to cover, like, we speak of factors of experience, everything that comes into the range of experience. And so, like, one of the groups that's included in contemplation of dhammas is the five aggregates. So even though one starts off observing just the in and out breathing, which belongs to the form aggregate, but as the focus broadens, when one reaches the stage of insight, then one is taking in every aspect of experience. So one brings all five aggregates in. Anybody else have any ideas about this?
Not
Stephen.
Not so much a different idea, because again, giving up wanting and not wanting. I'm fascinated to know, though, how you see that that's not a sufficient explanation.
That was not a sufficient.
That when one has a deep understanding of impermanence or has a sense of equanimity, how that's not a sufficient explanation for you. I'd like to know how you work with that.
I didn't say that wasn't a sufficient explanation.
Oh.
I just asked whether anybody else has any ideas. I didn't say that it was insufficient. I just thought,
Thank you,
that one could look at it from, perhaps one could see it from a different perspective. Maybe Peter has.
Well, I have one other idea, Bhante, which is when you think of the four tetrads in terms of the four foundations, and you think of the word Dhamma and all the nuances of meaning, one of which is simply the teaching of the Buddha.
Of
right?
Dhamma, I see.
Yeah. In the first three, you've got, as you said, tranquilizing of the feelings, the body, the mind. In the fourth tetrad, it's almost as if this is the culmination, this is what one does, right? This is the. So it's That, to me, brings to mind the idea of Dhamma simply as what we ordinarily think of it as, not mind-object necessarily,
yeah.
or even phenomena,
yeah.
but just the core teaching of the Buddha.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, and I think that's another way to look at it, that in the first three tetras, of course, these are things taught by the Buddha, so in a general way, they come under the Dhamma, but they're not yet, you might call it the core Dhamma, you know, the heart of the Dhamma, you know, the unique or special, what pertains to the special realization of the Buddha, that particular, you know, those teachings that are explicitly connected to the arising of wisdom. But here, with contemplating impermanence, fading out, cessation, relinquishment, now we come into contemplating things from the perspective of the teaching, from those teachings which bring the arising of wisdom. Yes, this is actually another way to look at it. In fact, when we take, not from this sutta, but from the Satipatthana Sutta, when we take Dhamma-anupassana, what comes under Dhamma-anupassana? Anybody refresh my memory? What comes there?
Things like Four Noble Truths.
Well, we have to get, I always insist people have to get things in the right sequence.
Oh, the five hindrances?
Yeah. And then next. After you get the first, I'll accept some degree of disorder. Anybody else? What?
The asavas, the floods, the four asavas?
No, they're not there. Yeah, no.
Five
aggregates. Seven factors of awakening.
Wait, first?
The five aggregates.
Okay, the five aggregates.
And what you said, seven factors of enlightenment.
Seven factors of enlightenment.
The sixfold base comes before them.
Yeah, the six internal and external sense bases come right after the aggregates. Then the seven factors of enlightenment, then comes the Four Noble Truths. And so we could say that all of these things, five hindrances, five aggregates, six sense bases, seven factors of enlightenment, Four Noble Truths, all of these things we could say are factors of experience, but it's not just, they're not just laid out as a kind of random catalog of items and experience, but they're organized from a particular perspective, particular point of view. And that is the perspective or point of view of the Dhamma, of the Buddha's teachings. And so we're progressing here from the five hindrances as things to be overcome, to be abandoned. Then we come to two alternative schemes for contemplating the actual nature of experience, either by way of the five aggregates or by way of the six inner and outer sense bases. Then as the contemplation of aggregates or sense bases becomes firm and steady, then the contemplation gives rise to the seven factors of enlightenment. And then when the seven factors of enlightenment all come together at a level of sufficient maturity, then they bring the realization or penetration of the Dhamma in the sense of the critical teaching, which is the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so now let us try to see. We have two statements here. So the first is, on that occasion, the monk abides contemplating Dhammas as Dhammas. And then we have, having seen with wisdom the abandoning of covetousness and grief, he closely looks on with equanimity. This is a bit subtle, but I'll just throw my fishing hook out into the water. Excuse me, that simile is perfectly non-lethal. Just ask if anybody can relate that to contemplation of dhammas. Okay, I said this was a bit subtle. So I'll give my own interpretation. This is the way I understand it. It's not based on any commentary. Okay, so we have first putting away covetousness, that's abhijja, and greed, I don't like grief, dejection or displeasure. Okay, now it seems possible to connect or to correlate abhijja, this craving or desire, with the first of the five hindrances, which is sensual desire. And in fact, in some passages on the abandoning of the five hindrances, we find that the overcoming of the first hindrance is explained not as the overcoming of sensual desire, but as the overcoming of abhijja. This is the case in the standard passage on eliminating the five hindrances. For example, if we go to page 366, this is from Sutta number 39. And then we go to paragraph or section number 13. So it's explaining, okay, the monk, after going to a secluded place, he sits down, crosses his legs, and sets up mindfulness before him. Then it says, abandoning covetousness for the world, that is abhijja. He abides with a mind free from covetousness. Okay. But then, as you read on, you see that he abandons ill will, he abandons sloth and torpor, he abandons restlessness and remorse, and he abandons doubt. So here, clearly, we have the five hindrances, but the first hindrance is not called kamachanda, sensual desire, but rather it's called abhijja. So when we come to the Anapanasati Sutta, we could see that there's a connection between abhijja, the covetousness, and the first of the hindrances. Okay, now the second term is that we find here is dominasa, which is normally understood as a feeling of displeasure, a feeling of dislike or sadness. But that kind of feeling is usually or associated with what kind of response to things, what kind of mood of mind.
Aversion.
Who said that? Yeah, aversion or in terms of what we usually use for the hindrances? Okay, ill will. So aversion, ill will. So they're not exactly the same, but there's a correlation between them. So we have here the abandoning or overcoming of having, let me see. So he sees with wisdom the abandoning of covetousness and grief. So this implies overcoming the five hindrances, which the five hindrances are the first group under contemplation of Dhammas. Okay, then it continues, having seen with wisdom the abandoning of covetousness and grief, he closely looks on with equanimity. Just see if we have Pali here. So but it's, I think it's sadhukam achupekati. But the key word here, we take, turn the verb into the noun, is upeka, equanimity. Now, where does equanimity belong? Where do we meet equanimity elsewhere?
It's one of the divine abodes, and it's also one of the seven faculties.
Yeah, okay. Here we're not concerned with the divine abodes, in which upeka is more like impartiality. But you said the seven factors of enlightenment? Yeah. So upeka is the last of the seven factors of enlightenment. And do the seven factors of enlightenment have any place in the four foundations of mindfulness? Where do they belong?
Number four.
Yeah, they belong to the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So here we have the first, by overcoming desire, or abhijja and dominasa, desire and displeasure, we could see the reference to the overcoming of the five hindrances, the first set within the contemplation of Dhammas. And then by contemplating that abandoning or looking upon it with equanimity, we see an allusion to the seven factors of enlightenment, which also belong to the contemplation of Dhammas. So we have the first set and the fourth set. And of course, there's not going to be mention of the Four Noble Truths because that doesn't fit in neatly here. But overcoming the barriers and then bringing to maturity the positive factors, which are the seven factors of enlightenment. Okay, so that now takes care of the connection between the 16 phases of mindfulness of breathing and the four foundations of mindfulness. Any questions at this point?
Pante, I wonder if you can say a little bit more about contemplating what it is, or even how long does it in practice?
Oh, I did that.
Did you do that? Okay, then I'll...
Yeah, I did that at the last class. I explained sort of... Okay, just very briefly, I'll treat it just very briefly, not in detail. Okay, in the three previous sections, as I said, are concerned with focusing the mind in order to develop concentration. Okay, now to switch over to the contemplation of impermanence, at least this was the way my meditation teacher in Sri Lanka taught us. He said that one, as one is breathing in, first one begins by making the observation that in breathing in, one is breathing in, that when breathing out, what is breathing out, which is not as in the earlier step, but what one is doing now is noting the distinction of the in-breath and out-breath, so that when the in-breath is occurring, when the out-breath is occurring, the previous in-breath is no longer occurring. It's gone. Then when you finish the out-breath and turn to the next in-breath, then one becomes, recognizes the previous out-breath is no longer occurring. It's gone. So one moves from just a general awareness of the breath with concentration to a distinction of the difference between in, out, in, out. Then one goes on, so there is like a core, already a somewhat coarse perception of impermanence. Then after a certain point to refine it, one starts to notice the distinction in one in-breath. You could divide it into the beginning of the in-breath, the continuity of the in-breath, or the sustaining the in-breath, the end of the in-breath. And so one sees each stage is different from the others. The same with the out-breath. Beginning is different from sustaining the out-breath, which is different from the end of the out-breath. And even one notes that little moment of pausing between in-breath and out-breath. Okay, and then one refines the attention on that way, and that gives a still finer seeing of impermanence, because one is seeing how each breath has three phases. Then, as the attention becomes more refined, one starts noticing that even within one in-breath, one is sort of, there are like little pauses and then accelerations, little sort of slowing down acceleration. So one starts seeing the discrete packets within an in-breath and an out-breath, and how each is different from its predecessor and successor. And then it goes more and more sharply until one is seeing each in-breath is like, almost like, to use a spatial analogy, it's like the way you get an image on a computer from pixels, which if you blow up the screen somehow, you see the individual pixels. So each in-breath is like a string of pixels of in-breathing, and each out-breath is like a string of pixels of out-breath, each arising and passing away.
So it's experiential.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And it could involve discursive thinking to some extent, or
it's not like a jhanic state where the thinking is completely gone. So there is formulation of discursive thoughts. So it's not, with the mind wandering away from the object, but when recognizes.
And when you contemplate the fading of passion, is that connected as well to the breath, or is that more subtle?
I think what's both. You see, the word here, I explained this in the previous class, which we have the translation here following Yanamo, the contemplating fading away, which is viraga. And I explained the last time that the word viraga has two nuances. The usual, within the more ethical context, is dispassion, the end of raga, which is lust or greed. But within the contemplative context, it's really more fading away or disappearance. And I recommended last time a book we have in the library, but forgetting like detailed explanation of these contemplations, it's by Venerable Sri Jnanarama. It's the N with a wiggle over the top. Jnanarama is called the Seven Contemplations of Insight. It's published by the Buddhist Publication Society in Sri Lanka, but it can be obtained from their North American distributor, which is Pariyati, P-A-R-I-Y-A-T-T-I, pariyati.com. Probably
says that again.
Excuse me?
The title again?
The Seven Contemplations of Insight.
Okay. Thank you.
And if the author is Venerable Mata Sri Jnanaram, Wiggled N-A-N-A-R-A-M-A. Any other questions now on this section? Okay, so now we're going to move from 4 to 7. So how developing the 4 foundations of mindfulness brings the development of the 7 factors of enlightenment. And here we have, it's a somewhat easy, well, it's a partly easy job because we don't have to repeat the whole thing 4 times. But just the first foundation of mindfulness is taken as the model or paradigm, then the other 3 foundations of mindfulness just follow the same model. Okay, so the explanation begins with section number 30. Okay, so whenever the monk abides contemplating the body as a body, and so on that occasion, unremitting mindfulness is established in him. On whatever occasion, unremitting mindfulness is established in the monk, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused in him, and he develops it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in him. And if you pay close attention to the sentence, you see that the phrases used are not just alternative statements, are not just synonymous, it's not just a chance succession or sequence of 3 phrases. But the sequence is actually meaningful. Because what we have here are actually 3 stages in the development of that particular enlightenment factor. So we have, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused in him. And that indicates the initial stage, one is bringing into being that enlightenment factor. One is turning on the ignition, so to speak, or getting the ball rolling with that enlightenment factor. Okay, then the next phrase indicates the process of development. After it arises, then one has to sustain it and strengthen it. And so then, this is the middle stage, which is, and it's generally for everyone, long, drawn-out middle stage. He develops it. And then comes with the third phrase, there comes the third stage. By development, it comes to fulfillment for him. So this is the culmination, where it reaches full maturity. And you'll see that these phrases are attached to each of the 7 enlightenment factors. Okay, now, so that's the enlightenment factor of mindfulness. Now with section 31, abiding thus mindful, he investigates and examines that state with wisdom. I think the Pali uses the simple word tongue dhamma. That state. He investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it. Okay, so it seems, or it doesn't, the sutta itself doesn't define what is meant by that state, but I would take it to be the breath itself, the in and out breathing. So he's investigating and examining the in and out breathing with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it. And one of the verbs here, I think it's the one translated investigation, pavichayate, upaparikati, and parivimansati, I believe. Okay, so these terms indicate that this is a process of investigation. So this would be looking into the breath in terms of, again, the arising and passing away of the phenomena in the course of in and out breathing. So this is a process of investigation. So this is called the investigation of states, or investigation of factors of experience, or investigation of teachings, factor of enlightenment. The Pali for this, So here, Dhamma, in the expression Dhamma Vijaya Sambhojanga, Dhamma is indicated by that state, Tam Dhamma. But it seems to have, even though it's singular is used, Tam Dhamma, but it has a quite a broad range, so I think it could comprise all the factors of experience that are involved when one is examining in and out breathing. So whatever feelings arise, whatever states of mind arise, even though the base of the mindfulness, because this is contemplation of the body, so even though the base is the body, or whatever factors of experience arise in the course of breathing in and out are also being investigated with wisdom. So that they would be investigated in terms of impermanence, fading away, cessation, and then giving up the attachment to the relinquishment. And so even though it's said that one is investigating these states with wisdom, this wisdom here apparently is not yet, you know, the wisdom at the culmination of the path, but it's rather the beginning stage of wisdom. It's where the point where one has turned the simple mindfulness of breathing aimed at stronger mindfulness and concentration, turning it towards insight. Okay, then it says that again, we have the three stages of development. Then we have in one who investigates and examines that state with wisdom, and so on, tireless energy is aroused. On whatever occasion, tireless energy is aroused in the monk who's investigating, on that occasion, the energy enlightenment factor is aroused in him. Again, that's the first stage, the initial stage, And he develops it, the middle stage, then it comes to fulfillment in him, the third stage. Okay, then, it seems what's being described here is, you know, as one is able to observe the arising and passing away of phenomena within the in-and-out breath, the mind is as picking up, as this is the focus of insight. As the focus of insight becomes stronger, then the mind becomes filled or suffused with a stronger energy, so that those who are engaged in this contemplation, like the need for sleep, diminishes. So if one is practicing like full time, one can get by with just 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night, and one can go on contemplating for, you know, 2 or 3 hours at a stretch. And it might seem just like a half an hour has gone by, because there's a lot of energy in the mind. Okay, then what the next factor in one who has aroused energy, unworldly, or I think, or better, I think a better rendering, niramisa, is non-karmic rapture arises. That's because rapture or joy can be either worldly or carnal. You know, the joy connected with sense pleasures or getting worldly benefits. And then this is the joy that comes from spiritual joy would be also a good rendering. This is the joy that comes from gaining insight, having stronger samadhi and insight arising. Okay, so that signifies the arising of the enlightenment factor of piti, rapture or joy. Okay, then one who is enraptured, rapturous. Now, unfortunately, when we use that word, this translation was done by Nanamoli originally. Well, actually, I changed his happiness to rapture. So I did this, 1985, 86. Now, some group has come out with a series of books. I think these are these Christian fundamentalists about the rapture. So now the word rapture brings along this connotation of this time when the second coming of Jesus. I've never read any of the books, so I don't know the content. I think this is a time when the second coming of Jesus occurs and the virtuous people get enraptured and lifted up into heaven, and all of the unbelievers and sinners are left behind on earth to meet with catastrophe. So, have pity for poor translators who have no foreknowledge of what's going to happen to the terms that they use decades after they use them. Okay, so for one who is rapturous, then the body and the mind become tranquil. Actually, what happens when rapture or piti initially arises, there isn't that strong tranquility, but rather there's a kind of elation, exhilaration, which comes with sort of the initial burst of the rapture. But as one goes on contemplating and sort of gets accustomed to the rapture, then it loses its excitement and it sort of settles down. It's sort of like that feeling when you, excuse me for the worldly analogy, but it's like when your old computer has been bogging down and maybe the screen is getting botched up and the memory function doesn't work so accurately. So then when, you know, besides you go to Best Buy or the Apple shop, whatever, and you buy a new computer and you bring it home and it's sealed in the plastic wrapping and you open it up, open the screen and press the start button and it starts so quickly and everything is working smoothly and it looks so shiny and beautiful, then you feel really joyful and rapturous. Poor Carolyn doesn't have that experience. And then every day, maybe for the next week, you know, as soon as you wake up, you can't wait to open the computer lid and start the machine, waiting to see, bang, bang, swiss, swiss, chup, chup, light, light. And it's new programs and faster programs, more sophisticated programs. But then 2 months, 3 months after you've been using it, you know, you still like it because it's a new, capable, efficient machine, but you've gotten used to it. So that joy of using it has just quieted down and become something that you're accustomed to, something habitual. So then the tranquility sets in. Okay, so this represents the arising of the tranquility enlightenment factor, and then one develops it until it comes to fulfillment. Okay, then comes the next enlightenment factor, when the body is tranquil, and then one is feeling pleasure. Pleasure isn't mentioned as a separate enlightenment factor, but it goes along with that tranquilizing of body and mind. Then the rapture tends to fade into the background, and so the sukha, the pleasure, or the bliss, becomes more prominent. And then as the bliss becomes more prominent, then the mind becomes concentrated. So then the concentration enlightenment factor is aroused in him. Then he develops it, and it comes to fulfillment. Okay, then as the concentration factor matures, then the text says he closely looks on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated. And so when he's looking on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated, now the equanimity enlightenment factor has aroused in him. He develops it and it comes to fulfillment. So that takes us through the seventh enlightenment factor. Okay, then, as I said, the same template or model is used with the other three foundations of mindfulness. So that's how the four foundations of mindfulness developed and cultivated fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. There's something that's struck me a little bit strange about the enlightenment factors. Does anybody feel anything a little bit peculiar about the sequence of them? Maybe see if anybody else shares that feeling.
Wisdom precedes it?
Yeah, this is exactly what I had in mind. That we find the expositions, the way the Buddha usually expounds the training in terms of the three stages of virtuous behavior, concentration, wisdom. And then when we have this expanded into the five faculties, we have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Similarly, with the five powers, same as the five faculties. But it's a little puzzling why in the seven factors of enlightenment, the factor that corresponds to wisdom comes in the second place, And if one looks at the seven factors of enlightenment, it seems almost as though it's running parallel to the sequence in developing samadhi, you know, deeper stages of concentration rather than wisdom, because okay, we've come to rapture, okay, and then in the formula for the development of the jhanas, we have the first and second jhanas have rapture. Okay, then it goes through from rapture to tranquility to concentration. So then, in the second jhana, samadhi is mentioned. And then the enlightenment factors go from concentration to equanimity. And then in the sequence of the jhanas, we have equanimity mentioned in the third jhana. And then in the fourth jhana, equanimity becomes fully purified. So it seems here that there's a parallelism, not so much with the usual sequence, virtue, concentration, wisdom, but rather with the sequence of the four jhanas, except that the seven factors of enlightenment have to culminate in something that the four jhanas on their own don't lead to, which is what we come to next, which is here called Vijja Vimutti. That's translated true knowledge and deliverance. But now I prefer liberation. So we could say that the vijja here, this is the true knowledge, and this we could identify with the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, the deep flowing defilements, and then the liberation, that is the release of mind that comes when the defilements are all eliminated. And so the sutta then goes into the question, how do the seven enlightenment factors developed and cultivated fulfill vijja-vimutti, true knowledge and liberation? And then the Buddha explains, here the monk develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, each of the seven enlightenment factors supported by seclusion, and then the commentaries usually explain this as being secluded from the mental hindrances, supported by seclusion. Then we have here viraga, but now is the clearer sense here is dispassion rather than fading away. So it's supported by dispassion, supported by cessation. I think here in the sense that Nibbana has the cessation of suffering or the cessation of craving is the aim of the practice. And it's said to be practiced as ripening, maturing in relinquishment. The commentaries give very technical explanations of these terms, but we don't have to go into those technical details. But this is, I would say, this is indicating the development of the seven factors of enlightenment when they've reached that stage of a high level of development, not in the early stages, but now they've all become strong, mature, powerful, and now they're all being developed together And so now they all converge upon the aspiration to reach that final goal. And so when he develops them in this way, then they'll culminate in that true knowledge and liberation. And thus he ends by saying, that is how the seven enlightenment factors, I would say, are developed and cultivated so that they fulfill true knowledge and liberation. Okay, so that is the end of the sutta. And if you have questions, since it's now 11:25, just jot them down and hold them, and we could have some more discussion. We come back. Let's aim to be here at 12:30, and then we could have some more discussion for a half an hour. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. Thank you.